Now, while a calendar was important for business and other mundane needs, its accuracy was required primarily to determine the precise day and moment of the new year and other festivals and worship of the gods. Even today, the Jewish rabbis determine the holy days and correlate it or intercalate it to the solar year, which our calendars are based on, and the lunar calendar. To measure and correlate the intricate movements of sun, earth, moon, and planets, the Mesopotamian astronomer priest relied on a complex spherical astronomy. Earth was taken to be a sphere with an equator and poles. The heavens, too, were divided by imaginary equatorial and polar lines. The passage of celestial bodies was related to the ecliptic. The projection of the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun upon the celestial sphere. The equinoxes, the points and the times at which the sun in its apparent annual movement north and south crosses the celestial equator. And the solstices, the time when the sun during its apparent annual movement along the ecliptic is at its greatest declination north or south. All these are astronomical concepts used to this very day, but rather modern, and built into the pyramid. These ancient Mesopotamian astronomer priests were able to calculate all of this from a formula that they didn't necessarily understand, but by rote could do, because it came from an earlier source. Another way of saying, the Babylonians and Assyrians did not invent the calendar or the ingenious means for its calculation. Their calendars, as well as our own, originated in summer among the Sumerians. There, the scholars have found a calendar in use from the very earliest times that is the basis for all later calendars. That principal calendar and model was the calendar of Nippur, the seat and center of Enlil. Our present-day one is modeled on that Nippurian calendar. Based on that, the Sumerians considered the new year to begin at the exact moment when the sun crossed the spring equinox. That doesn't any time start the year. Well, before you start challenging these Sumerians, remember God said, these are the set times of the Lord, the feast days, the feasts of the Lord, literally the set times of the Lord. And he starts with the Sabbath, and then the first day of the month, the religious month, Passover. Is that in the spring or not? Now, we begin January through the heathen corruption of the worship of Tammuz, a later addition. But in ancient summer, the Sumerians considered the new year to begin at the exact moment when the sun crossed the spring equinox. Professor Stephen Langdon, in tablets from the archives of Dreham, found that records left by Dungi, a ruler of Ur, about 2400 B.C., show that the Nippurian calendar selected a certain celestial body by whose setting against the sunset it was possible to determine the exact moment of the New Year's arrival. This, he concluded, was done perhaps 2,000 years before the era of Dungi. That is about 4400 B.C. Now we're way back there, when man was crawling out of a cave. Can it really be that the Sumerians, without actual instruments, nevertheless had the sophisticated astronomical and mathematical know-how required by a spherical astronomy and geometry? Indeed, they had, as their language shows, they had a term, dub, D-U-B, that meant in astronomy the 360-degree circumference of the world, in relation to which they spoke of the curvature or arc of the heavens. You say, what has it got to do with me? Well, the Bible's got something to do with you. And all this is supporting the biblical position. There were some smart people who lived before the flood. Not only were they smart, we're dumb by comparison. But if we take our dumbness and live 900 years, man, I'm so much smarter than I was when I came here 10 years ago. I'm so much smarter now than I was when I got my PhD at Stanford in 1957. What a crime that youth is wasted on youth. I like George Burns' song. I wish he was 18 again. Give me the idea how smart we'd be if we could live building on the knowledge we now have 900 years. And let's just go back to Seth, our father, for how long we don't know, was privately tutored by God. Well, you know, I read that, but I never really expected to believe that in the Bible. Well, what do you think the book of Genesis means? Beginnings. These Sumerians had a term, dub. Now, that doesn't mean just because you're dubbing tapes out there, you're suddenly smarter. I want my engineers to get that. That meant in astronomy, the 360-degree circumference of the world, in relation to which they spoke of the curvature or arc of the heavens. For their astronomical and mathematical calculations, they drew the An-Ur, capital A-N, capital U-R, an imagined heavenly horizon against which they could measure the rising and setting of celestial bodies. Perpendicular to this horizon, they extended an imagined vertical line, the Nubu-Sarda. Spell it just like it sounds. With its aid, they obtained the zenith point and called it the An-Pa. They traced the lines we call meridians and called them the graded yokes. Latitude lines were called middle lines of heaven. The latitude line marking the summer solstice, for example, was called Anbil, translated fiery point of the heavens. The Akkadian, the fair-skinned conquerors of summer, called the black-headed ones, Hurrian, Hittite, and other literary masterpieces of the ancient Near East, being translations or versions of Sumerian originals, were replete with Sumerian loanwords pertaining to celestial bodies and phenomena, cognates. Babylonian and Assyrian scholars, am I boring you?
No,
sir. Babylonian and Assyrian scholars who drew up star lists and wrote down calculations of planetary movements often noted the Sumerian originals on the tablets that they were copying or translating. The 25,000 texts devoted to astronomy and astrology, said to have been included in the Nineveh library of Ashurbanipal, frequently bore acknowledgement of Sumerian origins. 25,000. Until the 1800s and Lawyer dug at Nineveh, we had no idea of this. The basic thought I am seeking to drive home is that man has not gotten progressively smarter from a very primitive Stone Age beginning. But man began with a source of knowledge, certainly a knowledge revealing a wisdom and knowledge that steadily deteriorated through the Middle Ages until it has now started to turn around. And we were tracing the knowledge of mathematics and astronomy back past Ptolemy, beginning with the realization that Pluto was not discovered in our universe as an additional planet until 1930. And pushing back, where did Joe go? Go get on the sound. And pushing back to the 2nd century A.D., we find that from Ptolemy in the 2nd century A.D. to Greek astronomers 300 B.C., the more ancient of those two had a superior knowledge. Their knowledge went back through Hittite and Babylonian sources, ultimately to the ancient Sumerian and the Nippurian calendar, which takes us behind even the Babylonians and ancient Mesopotamian valleys. The 25,000 texts devoted to astronomy and astrologers said to have been included in the Nineveh library of Ashurbanipal frequently bore acknowledgments of Sumerian origins. A major astronomical series that the Babylonians called, quote, the Day of the Lord, was declared by its scribes to have been copied from a Sumerian tablet written in the time of Sargon of Akkad in the 3rd millennium B.C., the conqueror of the Sumerians, Sargon the Great. A tablet dated to the 3rd dynasty of Ur, also in the 3rd millennium B.C., describes and lists a series of celestial bodies. You're getting better, but it isn't right yet. Now, I need to tell you, you hear a different sound out there on TV than those in this studio. And I've been battling the in-studio sound all evening. A tablet dated to the... And we're trying to fix it. A tablet dated to the 3rd dynasty of Ur, also in the 3rd millennium B.C., describes and lists a series of celestial bodies so clearly that modern scholars had little difficulty in recognizing the text as a classification of constellations, among them Ursa Major, Draco, Lyra, Cygnus, and Cepheus, Triangulum in the northern skies, Orion, Canis Major, Hydra, Corvus, and Centaurus in the southern skies, and the familiar zodiacal constellations in the central celestial band. I just made it worse. You got to distinguish between talking to you and talking to my engineer working on the sound. In ancient Mesopotamia, the secrets of celestial knowledge were guarded, studied, and transmitted by astronomer priests. It was thus perhaps fitting that three scholars who are credited with giving back to us this lost Chaldean science were Jesuit priests: Joseph Epping, Johann Strassmann, and Franz Kugler. Kugler, in a masterwork, analyzed, deciphered, sorted out, and explained a vast number of texts and lists, and in one instance, by mathematically, quote, turning the skies backwards, he was able to show that a list of 33 celestial bodies in the Babylonian skies of 1800 B.C. was neatly arranged according to present-day groupings of those same phenomena. So they were pretty smart, those people. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
This studio's killing me. Should have went home.
No.
Too cold again. The sound is lousy. You better stay awake. I'm getting more crotchety by the moment. My cigar won't even burn in here. After much work deciding which are the true groups and which are merely subgroups, the world's astronomical community agreed in 1925 to divide the heavens as seen from Earth into three regions. This is modern genius at work. To divide the heavens as seen from Earth into three regions, northern, central, and southern, and group the stars therein into 88 constellations. As it turned out, there was nothing new in this arrangement, for the Sumerians were the first to divide the heavens into three bands, or what they called ways. The northern way was named after Enlil, the southern way was named after Ea, and the central band was the way of Anu. And the Sumerians assigned to each of these three ways various constellations. The present-day central band, the band of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, corresponds exactly to the way of Anu, in which the Sumerians grouped the stars into 12 houses those many, many millenniums ago. In antiquity as today, the phenomenon was related to the concept of the zodiac. The great circle of Earth around the sun was divided into 12 equal parts of 30 degrees each. The stars seen in each of these segments or houses were grouped together into a constellation, each of which was then named according to the shape the stars of the group seemed to form. Because the constellations and their subdivisions, and even individual stars within the constellations, have reached Western civilization with names and descriptions borrowed heavily from Greek mythology, the Western world tended for nearly two millennia to credit the Greeks with this achievement. But it is now apparent that the early Greek astronomers merely adopted into their language and mythology a ready-made astronomy obtained from the Sumerians. We have already noted how Hipparchus, Eudoxus, and others obtained their knowledge. Even Thales, the earliest Greek astronomer of consequence, who is said to have predicted the total solar eclipse of May 28, 585 B.C., which stopped the war between the Lydians and the Medians, allowed the sources of his knowledge that enabled him to do that were of pre-Semitic Mesopotamian origins, namely Sumerian. We have acquired the name Zodiac. You're getting close. Just stop it there for a while. We have acquired the name Zodiac from the Greek Zodiacos Kyklos, which translates animal circle. Zodiacos Kyklos, animal circle, because the layout of the star groups was likened to the shape of a lion, fishes, bull, so on. But those imaginary shapes and names were actually originated by the Sumerians, or earlier. At least, we can trace them back to the Sumerians, who called the 12 zodiacal constellations Uli, shiny herd. One was Gu'anna, heavenly bull, Taurus. Try this on your companion when they give you trouble. Number two was Mashtaba, translates twins, our Gemini, as the heavenly bull was our Taurus. Dub, which translates alternately pincers or tongs, our crab or cancer. Ergula translates lion, which we call Leo. Absine, which means her father was sin, translates the maiden of Virgo. Zibaana, heavenly fate, for the scales of Libra. Gertab, which translates which cuts and claws, our Scorpio. The eighth one was Pabil, meaning defender, our archer or Sagittarius. Number nine was Suhermash, which translates goatfish, our Capricorn. Number 10, Gu, Lord of the Waters. Our words are the water bearer or Aquarius. Number 11 was Sim-ma, or fishes, our Pisces. Number 12 was Kumal, from field dweller, our ram, or Aries. So the Greeks didn't originate anything in that regard. The pictorial representation or signs of the zodiac, like their names, have remained virtually intact since their introduction in summer. Some changes, as we pointed out when we studied on God's message in the stars. I don't need to show you the figures of those various pictorial representations, and it is the accusation of Romans 1 from the mouth of Paul that man began to worship those images and the creature instead of the Creator. Until the introduction of the telescope, European astronomers accepted Ptolemaic recognition of only 19 constellations in the northern skies. By 1925, when the current classification was agreed upon, 28 constellations had been recognized in what the Sumerians called the Way of Enlil. We should no longer be surprised to find out that, unlike Ptolemy, the earlier Sumerians recognized, identified, grouped, named, and listed all the constellations of the northern skies. Didn't miss one. Of the celestial bodies in the Way of Enlil, 12 were deemed to be of Enlil, paralleling the 12 zodiacal celestial bodies in the Way of Anu, likewise in the southern portion of the skies. Enlil, the northern portion, Ea, the southern portion, Anu, the central equatorial portion. In the southern portion of the skies, the Way of Ea, 12 constellations were listed, not merely as present in the southern skies, but as of the god Ea. In addition to these 12 principal constellations of Ea, several others were listed for the southern skies, though not so many as are recognized today. The Way of Ea, the southern skies, posed serious problems to the Assyriologists who undertook the immense task of unraveling the ancient astronomical knowledge, not only in terms of modern knowledge, but also based on what the sky should have looked like centuries or millennia ago. Observing the southern skies from Ur or Babylon, the Mesopotamian astronomer could see only a little more than halfway into the southern skies. The rest was already below the horizon. Yet, if correctly identified, some of the constellations of the Way of Ea, the southern way, lay well below the horizon. But there was an even greater problem. If, as the scholars assume, the Mesopotamians believed, as the Greeks did in later times, that Earth was a mass of dry land resting upon the chaotic darkness of another world, the Greek Hades, a flat disk over which the heavens arched in a semicircle, then they shouldn't have had any constellations in the southern skies at all. Your proof, therefore, they had the spherical concept, the right one. Restricted by the assumption that the Mesopotamians were beholden to a flat earth concept, which much of earlier scholarship held, modern scholars could not permit their conclusions to take them too much below the equatorial line dividing north and south. The evidence, however, shows that the three Sumerian ways encompass the complete skies of a global, not a flat earth. In 1900, T.G. Pinches reported to the Royal Asiatic Society that he was able to reassemble and reconstruct a complete Mesopotamian astrolabe, literally taker of stars. He showed it to be a circular disk divided like a pie into 12 segments and three concentric rings resulting in a field of 36 portions. The whole design had the appearance of a rosette of 12 leaves, each of which had the name of a month written in it. Pinches remarked, or rather marked them, 1 to 12 for convenience, starting with Nisanu, the first month of the Mesopotamian calendar. I'm not going to show you that figure. It's too complicated. Each of the 36 portions also contained a name with a small circle below it, signifying that it was the name of a celestial body. The names have since been found in many texts and star lists, and are undoubtedly the names of constellations, stars, or planets. Each of the 36 segments also had a number written below the name of the celestial body. In the innermost ring, the numbers range from 30 to 60, in the central ring from 60 to 120, and in the outermost ring from 120 to 240. What did these numbers represent? Writing nearly 50 years after the presentation by Pinches, the astronomer and Assyriologist O. Neugebauer, in A History of Ancient Astronomy, Problems and Methods, could only say that the whole text constitutes some kind of schematic celestial map. Come over here, I'm going to let you take a picture of it. In each of the 36 fields, we find the name of a constellation and simple numbers whose significance is not yet clear to this scholar and Assyriologist. A leading expert, that's why I'm going to show it to you, such fine print we can't pick it up. But that's the chart that if you could look close at the detail, you would begin to see. Notice the little 12 circles right here in the middle. In 1900, T.G. Pinches reported the Royal Asiatic Society that he was able to reassemble and reconstruct a complete Mesopotamian astrolabe. There's a picture of it reproduced here that I showed you quickly. And yet, writing nearly 50 years after the presentation by Pinches, the astronomer and Assyriologist O. Neugebauer, in A History of Ancient Astronomy, Problems and Methods, could only say that this ancient astrolabe construction and the text that was on it constitute some kind of schematic celestial map produced by these ancient Mesopotamians. In each of the 36 fields, he says, we find the name of a constellation and simple numbers whose significance is not yet clear. Now, if the Assyriologist can't understand it yet, it's too hot in here, Mike, then I'm sure we can't. But the point is, they had a knowledge far in excess of the movements of the heavenly bodies.
This is the end of Side 3.